You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB. This is Janae Cummings.
And I'm Scott Weddle. This is the Daily Local News for Wednesday, October 12, 2016.
The whole entire international community, they deserted the Syrians. You might call it the ethical crisis.
The Bloomington area is preparing for the arrival of Syrian refugees. More on that story later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, a new edition of our Consumer Watchdog segment, Better Beware. But first, your daily headlines.
The Bloomington Plan Commission has approved a housing project associated with the planned Tech Park, also known as the Trades District. The city's assistant planning director, Josh Desmond, told the commission that the project will be located on approximately 2 acres at 611 North Rogers Street in downtown Bloomington.
This is a four-story multifamily building being proposed for this site. It would contain 65 total bedrooms within 36 actual units. All units within this building are proposed to be affordable units for folks at or below 60% of the area median income, and that would be for a period of 30 years. If you look in the foreground of this rendering, you can see that some of the parking is actually covered with carports. That would be part of the solar panel array for this overall site.
Desmond said the project provides more than 60 parking spaces and includes a number of environmentally friendly features. The project is being developed by the Carmel, Indiana-based Pedcor Investments, a developer of affordable housing. Pedcor Vice President Brandon Delk said it's part of a statewide initiative called Moving Forward, the goal of which is to reduce housing and transportation costs for low and moderate income families. Commission President Jack Baker told Delk he felt a disconnect between the stated target population for the housing development and the salaries in the Tech Park. Those who live in the development are expected to earn between $20,000 to $45,000 per year.
Salaries in the Tech Park, I don't know what we're expecting there, but I would expect in a Tech Park area, those salaries would be much, much higher than that. Okay, there's a range, I agree, but here's the disconnect. Where are these people going to work? Are they going to find jobs that will sustain them eventually within this Tech Park area? Are they going to be the low end? Are they going to be able to find work in this where it might be an area of high paying jobs? They might not have the skills. That's why I'm wondering why this project is where it is. It seems like it's a project not really connected with the Tech Park. It's a project that would be maybe better suited in some part of the city to serve the community rather than being targeted for Tech Park.
Baker's comments tie in with some arguments made recently by members of the Bloomington Solidarity Network who have opposed development of the Tech Park. The Solidarity Network has noted that existing housing near the Tech Park area is already some of the most affordable housing near downtown. Representatives of the group have voiced concern that the Tech Park will drive up rent prices and won't employ residents of the existing neighborhood. Delk said the project fit the locale due to a combination of factors: the exorbitant cost of downtown apartments and the availability of transportation downtown.
These folks could already have jobs in the downtown area, but are forced to live on the outskirts of Bloomington and in the more suburban areas, use their own cars, have higher costs of transportation, utilities, etc. We're bringing those folks back into downtown, giving them low-cost housing, utilities, and transportation means to reach their jobs.
Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith said the combination of affordable housing and green building elements will be of great benefit to the community.
The solar
It's very exciting to me, all those green building features. This will be a very low impact building and a very sustainable building. And it's exciting to me to see those two come together, because why should it always be the rich people who can, the only ones that can afford something that has a long-term payoff?
Commission member Daryl Nair said the PEDCOR project not only fits with the Tech Park's master plan, but speculated it would support commercial projects that the commission may see in the future. Commission member Joe Hoffman agreed the project was an important boost for workforce housing, saying he anticipates the development will see high demand. The commission voted in favor of the Tech Park housing development.
Bloomington Bagel Company owner Sue Aquila has cleared one more hurdle in her effort to create a new home for her business. Members of the Bloomington Plan Commission voted Monday 6-2 to approve the latest site plan for replacing the Bagel Company's existing building. The new facility at 113 North Dunn Street would be 4 stories tall and would include 16 apartments in addition to the restaurant. Senior planner Jackie Scanlon provided an overview of the proposed plan. Most of the housing units are what was known as micro-apartments. Architect Doug Bruce, who represented Bloomington Bagel Company, said the micro-apartments are a favorable alternative to the 5-bedroom apartments city officials have said they don't want.
We need to promote a variety of different housing, various housing types, and this is a new one to the city of Bloomington. These micro-units have worked in other areas, and sometimes they've had to come in too late to the game. This one brings this new housing type, and I would add that as the Switchyard Park comes along, which will be City of Bloomington's largest city park, which is very walkable to our downtown, I think you're going to see more people move downtown, and again, looking for different housing types. Because now you'll live here and have access, especially if you want to live downtown, to the B-line, and then the B-line to the Switchyard, and the Switchyard is going to be a huge draw. It's going to be like having grass on your toes, but not having to have a front yard to do it, which we don't have downtown.
Bruce went on to say he thinks the revised site plan will create a better pedestrian experience. Commission member Joe Hoffman said he was comfortable with the plan. Commission members Nicholas Kappas and Isabel Piedmont-Smith said the proposed building's height and design prevented them from supporting the site plan. Piedmont-Smith said she wanted to support the local business, and she liked the variety and affordability the micro-apartments provided, but she feared the new building would set a precedent that could change the character of downtown.
I serve on this body as a representative of the City Council, and everyone I've spoken to about this thinks it's an inappropriate size and architecture for this site. I don't expect new construction to mimic the older high-quality buildings in the area, and I recognize some of them are not high-quality, but I do think that new construction should tie in with the older buildings, should be compatible, should have some elements that in common with the older construction. Some of the other new construction in the area does fit in better with older buildings, like the Carmichael Center or the Rubicon, which I think the same architect worked on. Also, the taller buildings along Kirkwood are stepped back. If they're a tall 3-story, they are stepped back from the street. So it's not the same look at all.
Commission President Jack Baker said the site plan was reasonable because buildings in the broader area already have a mix of heights.
Papa's parking garage. It's listed here as the parking garage is 51 feet. This building is 51.6 at its highest. We have Rubicon Apartments on Kirkwood. 51 feet. This one's 51.6 at its highest. Von Lee, 48 feet. This one is 51.6 at its highest. So we have 3 or 4 buildings already in the area that are in the 51-foot height area. We also have others that this one without the tower is 41.6. We have, of course, Poplar's at 81. We have Dunkirk Square at 41, the library at 33, Trinity Episcopal at 40 feet, Carmichael Center at 42. Again, this is 41.6 without the stair tower. So we have a mix in this area.
The commission later voted in favor of the site plan. The plan will next be reviewed by the City Council.
The National Center for Education Statistics finds that about 1/5 of new public school teachers quit before the end of their first year due to job pressures, while nearly half of them don't last more than 5 years. A recent study conducted by Wallet Hub, a personal finance website in Washington, D.C., determined the best and worst states in the U.S. for teachers. The best ranked state was New Jersey, and the worst was Hawaii. Indiana was ranked 25th. A panel of experts across the country evaluated the biggest teacher issues: employment attraction, performance-based competition, and the value of teachers' unions, to find where every state stood in terms of teaching environment and policymaking. Areas examined included issues of low pay, high stakes standardized testing, decreased public school funding in favor of charter schools, and lack of respect and professional development opportunities. Survey panelist Eleanor Blair, associate professor in the School of Teaching and Learning at Western Carolina University, says American students are incredibly diverse in background and culture, and teaching should focus on their strengths, not their weaknesses. She also deplores the intense testing they are subject to in top-down micromanaging efforts to measure teacher accountability through standardized testing. She says, quote, "Just because I weigh myself every day doesn't mean I lose weight. Scales are just a tool," unquote. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Scott Weddle.
And I'm Janae Cummings. The Bloomington area is preparing for the arrival of Syrian refugees as soon as March of next year. WFHB correspondent Leah Carter has more on that story for today's WFHB Community Report.
Despite opposition from Indiana Governor Mike Pence, the State Department recently accepted Exodus Refugee Immigration's request to start resettling refugees in Bloomington, Indiana. Diane Legomski, the coordinator of the Bloomington Refugee Support Network, discussed what the network and Exodus are doing to prepare to settle the new refugees, many of whom will be coming from Syria in March of next year.
Right now what we're doing is trying to prepare really the community to welcome the refugees. We're trying to get a lot of resources together that Exodus and the refugees will need, and also trying to educate other organizations about sponsorship of the refugees. Generally, 10 people from an organization would sponsor a family and provide, you know, mentoring and other kinds of support, rides, help with translation, things like this. Things to complement the things that Exodus would be doing. Exodus will help them find a place to live on their own, an independent apartment or house. And Exodus does help with rent for up to 3 months. The idea is for them to hopefully be self-sufficient, you know, within 4 months, or not need a whole lot of extra help. And that's where the sponsors, you know, will come in. So Exodus will actually find... help them find housing that they can afford, and also will help them find employment, and will give them English skills and other cultural skills so that they can assimilate more quickly. So we'll be getting Syrian and from the Democratic Republic of Congo, so we're trying to have some educational opportunities about those cultures, and also trying to familiarize different organizations about what's involved in sponsoring a family, so that they'll be prepared.
Diane Legomski also discussed the problems which specifically Syrian refugees face when arriving in the United States, including the trauma of war, grief, and language barriers.
Largely, it's the trauma of war, which is so hard, you know, it's hard for any of us, I'm sure, to understand what they've been through. They've lost family members. They've lost their own homeland. It's, you know, multiple kinds of trauma that they're going through, a lot of physical injuries, of course, and health problems. They are vetted, they're medically screened, so the health problems aren't things that lead to contagion, but just a lot of weakness and so forth. And then there are language issues. Some of the refugees who come, they speak fluent French, and they're able to have a million translators, you know. But sometimes there are language issues. Culturally, they seem to be have found a good happy medium of assimilation, but also retaining their own culture. So that's been very nice. But you know, coming from a war-torn country, they've lost most of their belongings. They've lost their funds just by their efforts to come to a safe country. they really don't have much left anymore. So, you know, when you're coming from a war-torn country, you've really lost everything.
I also went to the Panera Bread on 3rd Street to meet with Abdul Baram, an electrical engineer in Bloomington who moved out of Aleppo almost 50 years ago. He talked about the reasons why people are leaving and the hardships which Syrian citizens face. In addition to struggling to survive and get basic necessities, people are living under the threat of attack every day, he said.
No jobs, their house being hit, children killed. So they have got hit in many ways. Economically, there's no job. On shelters, their home destroyed. And some of their children and relatives as well killed. So and they do not, have alternative resources to support themselves. And they need always help. However, help, going to Syria, very limited. Most of the help is going to the refugee camps, but my family, they are not in refugee camps. All of them still inside Syria. So they don't receive much help. It's very difficult life, very difficult. What I cannot identify any resources where they are receiving any help. They just surviving on whatever they have or whatever they can acquire. But there is no continuous support. There is no established support to help them.
Abdul has also lost people who he knows to the war in Syria.
I have many friends and many members of my families. They were killed and some of them injured at different occasions, And some of them, they bombed their homes. They were sitting inside the home, and they bombed the house or their homes and killed under the rubbles. So there are many of them, either they are killed home or killed going to get bread or get food or going to their works if they have work. Many of them, actually, they had to leave home immediately because they heard airplanes is coming to hit them. Some of them killed on the street, some of them killed in their houses, some of them killed at the bakeries, some of them killed, they are going to find work.
Abdul Baram believes that in order to resolve the crisis in Syria, the international community should be giving more support to the Syrian people in the context of giving more aid and helping Syrians to leave the country.
The whole entire, international community, they deserted the Syrians. You might call it an ethical crisis. You might call it careless.
Don't worry about you.
Whatever you want to characterize it and describe it. But the Syrian people, they are true victims of the negligence of the international communities. For ordinary citizen here in the United States cannot imagine and cannot really figure out how those people surviving over there. It's a very difficult situation. So, again, the Syrian people are victims. Victims of the civil war that's going on in their country, and victim of the international community, they do not provide enough support and help, at least to survive.
The war in Syria has caused 5 million refugees to flee their home country and has internally displaced 6 million more. Most go to Turkey or Europe, and very few have come to the United States, with the quota for Syrian refugees set at 10,000 people per year. With the help of organizations like the Bloomington Refugee Support Network and Exodus Refugee Immigration, a few of them will make it to Bloomington next year.
You can hear that story in all WFHB community reports online at wfhb.org.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service. Now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Support for WFHB also comes from Growing Opportunities, a social business project of the South Central Community Action Program. Growing Opportunities is an urban hydroponic farm that provides job training opportunities for low-income people with barriers to employment, especially people with disabilities. They grow produce that is sold to local eateries, supermarkets, hospitals, and schools. Information is available at 812-332-2168 or online at insccap.org.
Up next, our weekly consumer watchdog segment, Better Beware.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Each week, we report on consumer issues, especially the didos and pirouettes of the ripoff artists out there. And this time, there's some bad news and some good news. The worst of the bad news, really, is how many con games are going and how well they're doing. The Better Business Bureau estimates that people lose $50 billion to scammers every year. $50 billion! No matter how you slice it up or allow for inflation, 50,000 million smackers is plenty enough to keep armies of grifters rolling in dough and attract boatloads of new ones all the time. And maybe you'll be surprised to learn that younger people are more likely to be diddled than senior citizens. According to the BBB, who compiled statistics from over 30,000 cases, only 11% involved older folks, while 34% of the victims were between 18 and 24 years old. One of the hot scams at the moment is fake home contractors. These itinerant lowlifes are storm chasers, looking for victims, people whose property has been damaged. If you've had storm damage, beware of any contractor who knocks on your door or calls your phone, especially if you've never heard of them. Double especially if they're from out of state, and triple especially if they want you to cough up some money before they do any work. Another ripoff that follows bad weather involves used cars. There's been some really bad flooding in places recently. You've probably seen news footage of cars submerged, people being rescued, and so forth. Flooded cars should get a special salvage title. But if a car can be dried out fairly quickly and put up for sale before obvious rust sets in, all too many individuals and dealers will try to conceal the fact that it was ever damaged. Dampness in the trunk, fog in the headlights, and rust on the seat rails are hard-to-fix giveaways, but the best way to get a tip-off is to check the vehicle's history on a website like Carfax. But there is some good news. Police in India have just taken a bite out of the IRS scam, which cost Hoosiers alone more than $30,000 last year, according to our Attorney General. In the city of Thane, in western India, cops rounded up some 750 people, and so far have over 70 under arrest for running a boiler room call center, where the crooks called Americans, pretended to be federal tax agents, and threatened them with arrest if they didn't pay back taxes. The police say this gang was hauling in $150,000 a day. But now, the good guys have seized computers, servers, and over 800 hard drives with links to other crooks in other countries, including some in America who were getting 30% of the swag. So there may be more busts to come. At least, we can hope so. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at wfhb.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@wfhb.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Kathy Norton, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, in partnership with Community Access Television Services. Better Beware was produced by Richard Fish. Our feature was produced by Leah Carter.
Our engineers today are Heather Perry and Rob Schoon. Our theme music provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, this is Scott Weddle.
And I'm Janae Cummings. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program, recognized among the best newscasts in 2015 by the Indiana chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. Send inquiries to news@wfhb.org. Stay tuned right now for Standing Room Only, our award-winning weekly lecture series, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.